Hello everyone and welcome to Sports Community Radio Podcast here at the studios of RPPFM, the voice of the peninsula. You're with your hosts, Jonah Veller and Steve Pallas. Steve Pallas, welcome to the show, mate.
Joe, it was good to be here. I'm recording my end of the deal from the sunny climes of the Murray River, Chikara and the mighty Murray River in Victoria.
Now, I think I made a quip last week about Arthur Leyland's or something to that effect, which you duly ignored, as you normally do, which is becoming truer by the week, because it must be at least 2 or 3 weeks now that you've been off-site, for want of a better word.
Well, yeah, I might have recorded one of the interviews from Harvey Bay last week in the Pilbara, this week in Echuca, Joe. But it's all part of researching and bringing together the latest in local sports clubs to our listeners. And Joe, I had the pleasure yesterday Melbourne Cup Day, and for the first time, I went to Melbourne Cup, but not at the Melbourne, not at Flemington Race Course, but the Melbourne Cup race meeting of the Echuca Racing Club on the Murray River. So, a fantastic day, and a lot to be learned from that little experience.
Wow! Did you get pick a winner?
Yeah. Well, as part of the crew that we were with, there was one gentleman named Phil, who's an avid listener to this show. G'day, Phil. He owned a couple of horses, so he one of his horses running at Echuca actually won on the day, so that was very good and lucrative for the rest of us that were there, and we all had a crack at some of the Melbourne horses, and quite a few winners through the day, so a lot of fun had by all.
And Palace family cleaned up in the office sweep, of course, taking out the first prize, young Miller, your daughter. 160, thanks you very much, on Protectionist, and your good wife took out the fourth prize, which is good as well. So, yeah, pretty good day all around by the Palace family.
Yeah, well, it was. And just going back to the Echuca races, we were in a group of about maybe 30, Joe, and everyone committed to go back to the Echuca races next year.
Wow.
And to me, when we do a lot of work with clubs on and how to create, you know, really good fundraising events and the perfect fundraising environment, one of the things we look to leverage off is the concept of tradition and the fact that we humans are creatures of habit. And so it was really interesting to watch. This was pretty much the first time that this group of people, my friends, and we've all got, for those many of you will know, we've got a cabin up here on the Murray River for water skiing. So there's about 15 or so families up here who went to the, many went to the Echuca Cup. And it was really interesting to see them say that, sorry, it wasn't the Echuca Cup, the Echuca Cup Day races. It was really interesting to see them all commit to coming next year. So no one, the Echuca Racing Club, and they said over the loudspeaker that the Melbourne Cup Day event was their largest fundraising event for the year. Well, they have to do nothing now to get, you know, out my group of 30 friends back, because they're now going to create a tradition where every year, by and large, we go to the Echuca races on Cup Day. A very easy way for the Echuca Racing Club in this instance to sell tickets, but the concept is all clubs can use is to create events that that link back to something and become a traditional activity.
And on that, we posted a Facebook post during Cup Week, raising the question of what clubs can do for a special event day such as Melbourne Cup Day, and the response. Whilst a lot of people looked at the post, there wasn't too much commentary on it, which may mean that there's quite a number of people out there that are not quite sure. And days like the Melbourne Cup are a golden opportunity, not just for race clubs who have a very, very strong relationship to the sport, but also for just any type of club, cricket club, football club, whatever it might be, to have an event as well. So there's information on our website on that as well, as, for anyone that's interested, www.sportscommunity.com.au. Events like the Melbourne Cup are gold for fundraising.
Yeah, I just cast my mind back to this time last year. We were doing training last year we were doing training in the Northern Territory, and we heard a story of the Noonamar Pub fog races that happen every year on Cup Day.
Yeah, that's right.
Now Noonamar is a pub in a town that's 50 kilometres out of Darwin, so quite isolated, with a population of 500. And each year, that pub makes $10,000 to $20,000, which it donates to charity, and it gets thousands and thousands of people back to its event every year, purely based on having a good time, and that becomes their tradition. They all go back, but it doesn't have to be the cup, and it doesn't have to be racing. It could be Mother's Day. You could have a Mother's Day event. You could have a Father's Day event, Boxing Day. After the cricket has made Boxing Day its own, the tradition could be the first weekend of November. Oh, sorry, the first weekend of July, or first weekend of this, or the last weekend in February. As long as it's repetitive and people can, automatically remember and associate that day with your event, then you've got a very, very strong chance of creating a tradition, which then, becomes a self-fulfilling, makes it a lot easier for volunteers year on year to sell the tickets because people are just automatically going back to that event. So it's in creating the perfect fundraising environment, creating an event or having events that rely on tradition and tapping into our basic human need of doing the same things, the creatures of habit, is a really, really good way of fund the clubs to look at fundraising and to look at it from a way of making it really a lot easier to sell the tickets, which is often the bane of many clubs.
Absolutely. And speaking of fundraising and events that affect clubs, just quickly, if you could, just maybe talk about a few of the grants that are out there in the marketplace, which listeners out there can access at www.sportscommunity.com.au.
Yeah, and then clicking on the grants tab, Joe. Yeah, look, as we're coming towards the end of the year, it's the first week in November, and so there's not a lot of new grants opening up, but there are certainly a lot of grants still open and available for clubs, no matter where you are in the country and what sport you participate in. So particularly facility grants, uniform grants, quick response grants, if you've had lost or stolen club information. So there's certainly lots of grants. What are the 60 or 70 grants open on the website at the moment? Western Australia's got the regional events scheme, which is funded by Tourism Western Australia. So most states and territories have that grant type open at the moment, where if you're a regional club and you want to put on an event, then by all means, there are grants available. And there's certainly a lot of grants available, apart from facilities, for inclusion programs and creating inclusion programs. So South Australia, Western Australia, and Tassie, certainly amongst the states that have got those sorts of grants. So lots of grants still open. They'll start to wind down as we get to Christmas, Joe, and then we'll look to see them open up early in the new year again. But certainly if you're looking for money, there are certainly grants. But remember, they're hotly contested, so allow yourself a fair bit of time to put together a good grant application.
Fantastic. Once again, if you're interested in grants, then go to our website, www.sportscommunity.com.au, and click on the grants tab. Now, mate, just wonder if you can relay a bit of the news that's happening that affects the world of grassroots sport.
Well, picking up on the concept of grants, there was a round of grants announced this week, which were from a Victorian round of grants, which was Vic Health. And their grants that they were looking to create programs for was Physical Activity Innovation Challenge. And Joe, you might remember last week, in last week's show, we referred to an article that Greg Norman wrote about the need for golf to think like a kid. And I really love that. I mean, that concept. I've been thinking about, I've been thinking over the last week, particularly as you have so jealously pointed out, I have been travelling a fair bit over the last week. So it gives you a lot of time to think. And two things that came out of Greg Norman's article was, one, that golf needs to think like a kid, but two, what he's really saying is we need to start innovating. And it got me thinking about sport and how well sport innovates. And it really doesn't do it very well. Many of the sports that are being played today are in the same format and the same structure and the same time and the same place as what they were played generations and generations ago. But there's one, the Bendigo, where am I looking at? The Bendigo Advertiser has just put an article up on their website, and it's titled, Orienteers Win $40,000 Grant to Boost Activity. And the article reads, and this is really cool, Joe, because it's orienteering is really not a sport that really gets too much airplay, or it's certainly not a sport that the majority of us would actually think about as one that we would consider participating in. It just doesn't just get that airspace or that coverage. But Bendigo Orienteers has secured a massive funding boost for a new program aimed to increase activity levels amongst primary students. Same old. The club received $40,000 to develop a modified treasure hunt competition based on orienteering to encourage children and their families to explore their local neighbourhood. Now, that's something the kids love, isn't it?
Absolutely.
They love a treasure hunt.
Yep.
So you've got this sport who's got it's an older demographic that traditionally played as well, and it's has got a relatively low, well, very, very low participation rate, and it's picked on an innovation. It's created an innovation using something that I reckon every kid has done, which is a treasure hunt, and absolutely loves. We all love a treasure hunt. So I think this is a tremendous, I'm going to continue to be looking for examples of where sports are, inverted commas, starting to think like kids. They're starting to innovate. And I think the Bendigo Orienteer is introducing the kids to orienteering via a treasure hunt of their local community, I think is an absolutely outstanding innovation. And to be fair, it's had a big sport because more than 100 groups applied for this for the grant, and only 12 were shortlisted as finalists. So it had to be a pretty special innovation to get through the 100 shortlist, to the shortlist of 100. So I think that's a great example, Joe, and I'm not sure your thoughts, but I think if we can kind of promote these sort of stories and get sports thinking more like kids and innovating, then I think we'll all be better off for it.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. Fantastic initiative, great concept. Exactly the kinds of stories that we want to, pass on to the sports community. Really, really good.
Yeah, and I'm just reading down the article as we're talking, or rereading the article, and they're going to target, it's almost the perfect concept in one regard, because they're going to target, we introduce the program through the primary schools, and then link them through to their orienteering clubs in due course. So they will distribute maps to every household and treat it like a seven-month event. It's an ongoing competition targeting physical activity and participation, which families can gain points by visiting the different places on the map. So it's getting the families to participate together, which, again, is one of the fundamental platforms of getting participation is to make it family-based. Another tick, tick, tick. So it's very easy to see why this well-thought-out program, Joe, was so so well received by Vic Sport.
Ah, that's fantastic. Now, I know you've probably got heaps to tell us about stuff that's going on in the world of grassroots sport, but I just want to bring to the attention of the listeners quickly one of the advantages that we have working in the space is that we can quickly identify the hot buttons or the issues that that the sports community is really interested in, and our social media was on fire the last few days over how to get your club into local media. And a lot of people have asked us about it, and the posts that we've had on Facebook have received quite a lot of views. So another one where you can get plenty of information at our website, www.sportscommunity.com.au, how to get your club into local media. So that's local press, newspapers, local radio, community TV, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's certainly always a hot button with clubs is how to get into the media. But as we're seeing, Joe, I mean, one of the real benefits of what we do is we get to see what the future looks like, I guess. And like we've talked often about the fact that clubs aren't actually going to need the local media soon because they'll be able to live stream their games. Well, they can already. You can live stream a game. You can create a radio show yourself. You can be publishing as much information as you want and building your audience and getting your club information out to very, very, very large audiences. And I think we're going to see over time, we're going to see that movement about, because all getting a club story in other people's, in the media, sorry, getting your story into the media is all about getting your story and then accessing other people's audiences. Whether it's you're getting your sport into the local newspaper and then the audience of the local newspaper sees the scores, whereas what we're going to see is more and more sports and clubs build their own audience. And I guess, Joe, that leads us beautifully into the next story that I just wanted to bring that's come up during the week. And it's really just that, about a sport looking to build and capture and maintain its audience. So Baseball Australia and the Australian Baseball League have announced the launch of the Australian Baseball Alumni, which is a really great concept, Joe, because what it's looking to do is to link together anyone that's ever been involved in baseball in Australia under the group and call it an alumni, or traditionally in grassroots sport we call them past players or past supporters and past presidents or past members or past sponsors. But that group of people that have been involved in your club and in your sport, but they still, even though they may not be any longer involved, they still want to get the information, they still want to get the news. So what Australian Baseball is looking to do is to, and I'll just read off their website, the baseball.com.au website. The official Australian Baseball Alumni Association launched opening its doors as a community for anyone and everyone that has enjoyed being part of the Australian baseball. Alumni members open to everyone, current or former players, coaches, umpires, scorers, administrators, sponsors, supporters, the ABA has created to reconnect with as many from the sport from past and present as possible. It's fully supported by Baseball Australia and the Australian Baseball League, and the community will be working towards helping grow the game in the future. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to bring everyone that's linked to the sport together so that they can continue to communicate with them using traditional media, but also their own direct media, and then with a view of using that as the platform to grow the sport. And I think that's a really, really incredible initiative that baseball have done, and we'll create a platform that, imagine Joe, even 5 years from now, everybody that's involved with the game today and for the next 5 years become members of that alumni. You know, that's an incredibly large group, and then as new people come in, they become members of the alumni, but all of a sudden that becomes a very, very large group of people that are passionate about baseball, that baseball can link into and provide information and results and all those things. And then from time to time, when baseball wants a little bit of help, you know, come to an event, come to a game, buy a membership, donate a dollar here or there. That's three or four times a year where the sport needs the support or wants the support, then it's got a direct access to its fans and its passionate client base. So incredibly, incredibly clever concept, and it's taking that concept that we talk about in the training, which is building your past players database to a whole new level.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's a great initiative by a sport that is really finding its feet in this country. And yeah, like you said, great way to just get some critical mass in terms of the membership. So fantastic by baseball.
Yeah, I think it won't be the first time we see this, Joe. I think more more and more sports, and again, now I'm talking clubs, now grassroots clubs, as more and more grassroots clubs begin to understand how big their audience is and the value of staying connected with their audience, they'll start to create more and more vehicles like this and reasons for the club or the sport to remain in touch with people who, let's face it, at one time probably genuinely loved the sport, and then for whatever reason their circumstances change and they move away from the sport, doesn't necessarily mean that they love the sport any less or want to be involved any less. So this is a really good example of ways that a formal structure of a way that a sport can keep in touch with its participants. And I guess leveraging off the concept of alumni is very much American college sport concept, Joe. So the American college sport, like its funding program, is very much driven by the alumni of each of the colleges continuing to stay close to their college and or university and continuing to be a financial supporter of that long after they've left the university. So I think that's only positive, and I think that's going to be a very strong way about how clubs are going to fundraise into the future by tapping into their past players and their past supporter bases by keeping in touch with them using things that weren't available to them not long ago, like live streaming of matches and email newsletters and podcasting and, all those sorts of things. So some really interesting things happening in sport. And although we've been quite critical of sport's failure to innovate, or we being me more particularly, Joe, up until the last 5 years, I think in the last 5 years, sport has really started to innovate. And the benefits of that innovation are now being seen, and it's driving innovation quite rapidly now. I think we're going to see it happen fast and furious over as part of the culture moving forward.
That's great, mate. Okay, well, I'll let you get back to that banana lounge on the banks of the beautiful Murray there. You've done your bit now and done it very, very well. And when we come back from a little break, which will be in a very short period of time, we'll be back with Rob Bennett, who's from the Australian Institute of Sport, and he's going to be talking about their groundbreaking market research called Market Segmentation into Sports Participation. So stick around. You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Jonah Vella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au. And there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review so you can help spread the news about sports community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs. Okay, welcome back to Sports Community Podcast. Here with your hosts, Jonah Vella and Steve Pallas. We've got a very special guest with us today. His name is Rob Bennett. He's from the Australian Sports Commission. And we've got Rob on to talk about, as mentioned at the top of the show, the report on market segmentation into sports participation. Welcome to the show, Rob.
G'day, Joe. Terrific to be here.
Rob, now I wonder if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about this groundbreaking report and why it was commissioned.
Joe, this is a really significant piece of research that the Commission undertook last year with a company called GfK Blue Moon, and it gave us some terrific insight into sports participation in Australia, particularly around clubs. It was very much clubs-focused, and it wasn't just the segmentation, so actually looking at the different groups potentially that could play in clubs, but it was some of the insights into what consumers want. You know, we call that the demand side of sport. So it was very much coming at it from the punter's side as opposed to the supply side, just traditionally how clubs deliver it. And some of the insights were quite fascinating, and it's really struck a chord with the sports sector over the last 12 months as we've rolled it out around Australia and spoken to various people about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, often grassroots sports clubs out there don't make the most of these kind of studies because, for better or for worse, they might think them too theoretical or too studious or inaccessible. But within this study, there's a lot of insights that are very pertinent to grassroots sports clubs, so your local sports clubs that we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole myriad of them at various levels, and we take that on board. We're acutely aware that it is difficult for clubs to see this sort of research and adapt because it's a tough world out there. You know, they're time poor, they're resource poor. They're reliant on volunteers who've got a lot on their plate. So changing how they operate and adapting to the sorts of insights that are in here, it's a tough job.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was the purpose of the study? So, you know, you've talked about the consumers out there. Is it solely for the consumers, for the industry? What was the reason behind?
So the outcome that we're trying to achieve is to get more Australians to play sport.
Right.
It's one of the pillars under which the Sports Commission operates. There's two, obviously. One is about being more successful internationally in high-performance sport, but the other pillar is we want more Australians to be participating in sport. And that's obviously where this segmentation is fantastic because it gives lots of tricks and tips and insights into what we need to do as a sector to make that happen.
Okay, so I'm going to start with the positive side of the equation, and I'm going to ask you, given what you've known through the study, why do Australians love and participate in their sport?
There's no rocket science. These are the sorts of things that you'd be expecting to hear. And look, good research generally is in line with your intuition. So we would have been a bit worried if it wasn't what we expected. But the drivers and the people's participation, and there's three key ones. The first is about the physical and mental benefits from sport. People are aware of that. There's self-improvement and achievement. So, you know, people want to get that sense of accomplishment, groups of people that want that sense of accomplishment. And then thirdly, and this is obviously a big one too, is the social benefit. So they're the three key drivers for Australians. Now, interestingly, those drivers are stronger for males. They ring through, resonate more with the males. But conversely, the barriers, and I'll talk about those with you in a moment if you like as well, they're a bit stronger for females. And so, you know, there's two key areas in terms of the barriers to participation. One are the practical barriers and the other are the personal barriers. The practical barriers are things around, you know, our busy lifestyles, so lack of priority, other commitments. It's hard for people to do. The other one is the personal barriers. And, you know, they're much more about perception, and it's things like sport is seen as too competitive. People have a fear of self-consciousness. They don't want to embarrass themselves. And the other barrier is just a lack of engagement with sport. They're just not connected to it. And as I said, those barriers, They're a bit stronger with the females. So the drivers resonate more with the males, but the barriers are stronger for females. Children are pretty similar, along similar lines.
Yeah, wow, that is really interesting. Now, one of the stats that that interest us at sports community is that 3.8 million adults, from the ages of 14 to 65 and 1.1 million under that age bracket want to be part of sports clubs but aren't. So, you know, those barriers that you talk about are very, very important. What are some of the ways that clubs could potentially overcome those barriers?
Yeah, the headline piece out of the research, Joe, is, as you say, more people will play sport, children and adults, but it needs to be presented differently.
Right.
And too much of what is currently being delivered in a way that focuses on competition and performance and within quite rigid schedules. We say, you know, if you want to play sport X, well, it's available on Saturday mornings between 9 and 12. That's it. So it's quite rigid in how it's offered. More people will play if there's a greater focus on fun, enjoyment, and the social side, with more varied, flexible opportunities. That, for us, is the headline piece. And if clubs don't get anything else out of this research, it just says, when you're offering your sport, think about that sort of as an approach. So we're looking for more people are going to play. We want it to have a greater focus on fun and enjoyment, more about the social side, so playing with friends, and looking at different times and ways that you can offer it. So, you know, if you're traditionally a Saturday morning or a Saturday afternoon sport, what about offering it a little bit differently on a Tuesday afternoon or a Friday evening? That's probably going to get more people playing your sport.
So I want to touch on that statement about the social side and the importance of the social side of sport. So I just wonder if you could maybe just speak more about what social side of sport means in terms of the research.
Well, one of the drivers, the three drivers, so a big one was the social benefit. So it's people's opportunity to play with friends, to be with friends. It's that social connectedness is very important for people. One of the interesting things for me that came out of the research is with the focus on competition in sporting clubs, we have there's quite a strong focus on competition. And one of the things that we see from that is that there's a fair amount of talent segregation. So we organise people according to their ability. And you typically, you know, an obvious example of this is what goes on in junior sporting clubs, as children move into adolescent years, and we go through grading processes. And so around that time, we start to segregate kids according to talent. So you might have a couple of friends, but one might be a much better player at a particular sport than the other. But, and so what happens is that better player is graded into a higher team, and his mate, who potentially isn't as strong, is graded into a lower level team. Potentially for one or both of them, a big driver for them could have been playing with their friends, so being with the friends. The friendship groups are really important. So as soon as we go through that segregation process, that key driver for them has been eroded. So, you know, and typically, you know, what you'd see is it's potentially not always, but often it's the weaker player, the one that doesn't get the recognition and the rewards, who's drifted off to play in the C grade with, that have the, you know, often it's the, they get the hand-me-down equipment and they punt it over onto the poor field and they get the dodgy lights and they haven't got the coach is often just a parent that's putting their hand up without any training and their whole experience just drifts away. And that's where we start to see people drifting away from sport. So that social side and its importance is really hot when you think about it in the context of how we segregate people's participation according to their ability.
Wow. If there's any clubs out there, I mean, you couldn't have wrapped that up better and the importance of that particular aspect, because I have seen it week in, week out on a weekly basis, parents and kids getting disappointed because of this segregation aspect. I just wonder, do you think the message of the research, these salient points that you're bringing up about participation, the social side, different formats, these kind of points, is filtering down through the state sporting organisations and the national sporting organisations and even the schools?
It's a long process, Joe. We've started to do that. As I say, we've done a roadshow over the last 12 months. We've got out and spoken to a lot of national sporting organisations, state sporting organisations, state departments of sport and rec, and it's slowly filtering. But this is going to take a long time. You know, the way sport has been delivered through clubs in Australia has been successful for a long period of time. And as I say, change in an environment where you're very resource poor, volunteer based, is hard. It's going to take a bit of time. So, you know, I'd be expecting there's probably clubs out there who could see these findings and go, oh, it resonates with them, but just what's involved in bringing about change isn't going to happen overnight. Some, you know, I've got to say, some of the biggest sports that do have the resources, we are seeing, they've already started moving down this path anyway. There's some good examples. So the way that AFL now offers AFL 9, so a modified form of the sport that is, it is more social, it's about fun and enjoyment. You have to get mixed forms of AFL 9. You see it also with things like tennis and their cardio tennis. It's a variation of the sport and offered at different times. It's shorter, so it fits in with people's busy lifestyles. It's got that strong fitness orientation, which for a lot of people is a driver. We spoke about the physical benefits of sport as being a driver, and so if you've got that fitness element in something like your cardio tennis, that's really attractive to some people. So, you know, some sports are already on the wagon with this and are moving down the path, but this is going to take a big change, a long term change.
Yeah, and I guess barefoot bowls is a classic case study in that.
Spot on. Yeah.
Along with the NSOs and the state sporting organisations and the schools and the departments, one of the key factors for us is parents, and a lot of that study was directed at kids as well. How can we change the mindset of parents? Because in my experience, and my experience is around soccer or football and little athletics and cricket and a few of the major sports, a lot of the time it's the parents that are driving this need for capturing the elite talent as opposed to the social benefits of sport. So how can we educate or maybe realign the expectations of parents out there?
Yeah, I think it's spot on, Joe. I think it's a major problem in sport, and where we see it most and where it manifests itself in a really ugly way is that whole ugly parent syndrome, where you've got, you know, parents on the sideline, you know, making massive emotional investments into the performance success of children's sport, and you know, for a lot of people, a lot of participants, a lot of children, coaches, other people around it, referees, officials, excuse me, that's a big turnoff. The parents need to be aware, you know, there are that although there are, you know, there's a fair chunk of children who do like the competitive side of sport, and they do play for those reasons. There are a significant chunk of kids who don't, and they need to sort of tap in and understand, well, why is your child playing? What are the drivers of your child? And it takes a fair bit of awareness of the drivers for children and why they want to participate. I need to make the point here, actually. I think it's really important because there has been some misconceptions about the research, and one was that the research was saying we've just got to get rid of competitive sport and just focus on this fun and enjoyment approach, which is wrong. That was clearly not what the research was saying. Mm. It was saying we need to cater for both. Mm. This isn't an either or discussion. There are a significant number of people that play sport for that competitive element. They enjoy that. They love that sense of self accomplishment and achievement. And being successful. We need to continue to do that. We cater for that very well in existing sporting clubs. But what we need to do, if we're going to get more people to play, then we need to offer this other approach needs to be prevalent as well, which is this one about fun and enjoyment. So, you know, and so for some parents, they might find themselves watching their children and they're playing in a competition that is talent-focused. So they might have been streamed into a talent-focused competition. An example that comes to mind is, football now has underage Premier League competitions throughout Australia, and they're clearly for kids that have been talent-identified. So that's you can see that that's going to be a little bit more competitive. They are, in fact, at development, but you can see there's going to be probably a more competitive element to that. But that's going to be could be quite different from a community-based under 13 Division 4 competition, which is competition by name but not by nature. These are people who are just playing because they love it, have fun, they're kids that want to just be with their friends. So we've just got to be really acutely aware of why children are playing, what are their drivers, and be sensitive to those, and parents adapting their approach accordingly. The big one for me, Joe, that in a longer presentation I'll talk about is the way that we try and shuffle kids into adult forms of the game at 11, 12, 13, 14. We insist on them moving to a competitive adult form of the game, whereas there's this big chunk of kids that love the modified sport that's offered sort of at primary school age and would keep playing sport if it was offered that way.
Wow.
Some of the more competitive ones, the more achievement-oriented ones, they want to move into the adult form of the game as quickly as possible, so we need to cater to them. But there's this big chunk of kids that love the modified form of sport, which is just about fun, enjoyment, being with their friends, and they'd keep playing if we offered that.
Do you have any feel or any statistical data on whether this trend where we're not catering or we're not flexible enough for sports clubs for the requirements of people who want to play sport, do we have any data on groups or individuals or numbers of people that are going out there and organising their own sporting ventures or activities to satisfy the flexibility and social requirements?
There's hard evidence around this, Joe. So the Australian Bureau of Statistics, ABS,
yep.
And also there was a research piece that the Sports Commission did in partnership with State Departments called ERAS that was done between 2001 and 2011. And what it clearly showed was that participation in participation in non-organised sport is climbing rapidly, but participation in organised sport, particularly through the ERAS Lunch Association Club specifically, is flatlining,
wow.
or in some cases declining.
Okay,
that
is a very important point for clubs to take into account out there. That this, clubs that want to increase their membership and want to do all the things to that they need to do to meet their objectives. Well, here's a whole market segment that is going elsewhere because we're not catering for them. And I just wonder also to that point, do we have similar evidence about individuals doing their own thing?
Yeah. There was another piece of research that the Sports Commission did in partnership with the CSIRO called around the mega trends. So it was the big trends that are occurring in sport over the next, that we're seeing and we'll see over the next 20 years. And there's some clear stuff in there. And there was a couple of the segments that really struck a chord and the tie in nicely with the market segmentation research. And one was two of them relate to the growth in new sports and people participating in sport on an individual basis. So one was called extreme to mainstream, and this is the growth in lifestyle sports, so extreme sports, those alternative, edgy type sports, a bit riskier, got a lifestyle element, people develop a cultural identity through them. So it's the growth of things like kite surfing, freestyle BMX, paragliding, the Tough Mudders. Now, all those sorts of things where people are doing it on an individual basis, and importantly, they can do it you know, there's that bit more flexibility often about when they can do it. It fits in with their busy lifestyle. And the second one that the Megatrends identified was the growth in was called a perfect fit. And this is this strong health and fitness focus that we see. So whereas, you know, people previously would get fit to play sport, what you see now is people playing sport to get fit. Now, people understand the importance of looking after themselves. Not enough Australians obviously do enough about it, but people are aware of the importance of trying to be fit and healthy. But it's much more individualised, and people do it can fit it into their own busy schedule. So it's the growth of non-organised sports such as, you know, it's the running, it's the walkers, it's the cyclists. We see big growth in gym memberships and the sales of home gym equipment, all those things. So these are all things that are competing with traditional club-based sport, particularly team sport.
Yeah, and you know, that should really resonate with a lot of our listeners out there and our clubs out there, because it's quite clear that there's a significant segment of people in the community that want to play sport. And as clubs, there's definite things that we can do to improve our chances of attracting those people out there to become members of our particular club. And I will say one very important thing is that often out there, you know, being an elite or perceived as an elite club is in my experience a very temporary thing, because coaches move from club to club, they take players, if you set yourself up as a club looking for just the best kids in the community, well then you may do well for a number of years, but it could all come crashing down very, very quickly. Whereas, you know, people who want to play sport for the enjoyment of it, the social side of it, that's never going to change. People are always going to want to play sport, and there's a lot of research out there saying that they want to play sport, we're not giving them the opportunity. So just, you know, for our listeners to keep that in mind. And I just want to thank you, Rob, for coming on the show, because you've really been able to wrap up that research and how it relates to grassroots sports clubs out there in a way that I think a lot of the listeners out there can take some of the points that you've raised and put action plans around them to help them at their clubs.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, mate.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pellis and Joe Novella, another Sports Community digital production, courtesy of www.sportscommunity.com.au.
Okay, we've come to the end of our show. I hope you've enjoyed it. You can find all our podcasts, of course, on our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au, where you get to listen to some great content as well as some fantastic people in the sports sector telling us all about their views and opinions. Once again, thanks for listening to the show. On behalf of myself, Joe Novella.
And me, Steve Pellis, thank you for making us part of your sports community.